We are going to put the QR code up after Mario Gabelli speaks during the See's Candy break, our awesome See's Candy Bar break. We thought we'd sweeten you up before you gave us your one piece of advice that you think would be a great suggestion for us to improve. Why do passive investors make terrible comedians? They lack timing. That's a keeper. Our next speaker, Rob Vanell, is a friend of mine who Rob and his wife Mary invited me over to their home when I was visiting Switzerland. Oh, I'm guessing 10 years or so ago.
Yeah, probably.
The kids were pretty small, so it's great to see them do so well. And I had really grown affectionate towards Lindt chocolate. And when I visited Rob and Mary at their home, they're kind of in the pathway of the smell from the Lindt chocolate factory in, help me with the name of the city outside of Zurich.
Kilchberg. Yep.
That's where Lindt's factory is. And you could just smell the beautiful aroma of Lindt chocolate. And it was a really fun visit. And that's one of the nice rewards that I get from organizing events like this, is meeting people from all over the world and then visiting them, sometimes speaking all over. And I really appreciated Rob's friendship and Mary's and their kind invitation. Rob has also invited me to his annual meeting, which was in the mountains of, you'll have to help me,
Engelberg.
And that was the first annual meeting that I attended outside of Davos World Economic Forum, where it was what was the altitude? Because we went up.
Yeah, about 1,000 meters at the village level, and it goes up to 3,000 meters.
Yeah, and that was really quite remarkable and memorable. So hopefully you'll invite me back to that. That was really
You're very
neat.
Welcome.
So before Rob began his career at Goldman Sachs in 1997, and then he started in 2006 RV Capital and runs the Business Owners Fund. And he's here today to talk to us about five moat myths. Please welcome Rob Vanell.
Thank you so much, Bob. I had a chance to speak to Bob briefly before here and said how much I was looking forward to Bob's jokes, and he told me, you know, he's struggling now to keep finding jokes as good as they used to be in the past, but Bob, you've still got it. And I actually hid one of Bob's jokes with his kind permission in my presentation, so we'll see if you can spot it. So I'm going to talk about myths, moats today. But before I get to that, I thought first just a few words about myself in case some of you don't know who I am. So I started RV Capital in 2006 with not a whole lot of money, no clients, no reputation. And so what I did was keep costs to an absolute minimum. And so that meant it was just me working there, and I worked from my home. This is the view I have from my house. And everyone at the time said, you know, this can't possibly work. You need a team of analysts. You need to be in a big city, and you need to have Bloombergs. And, you know, I couldn't afford that. So, but I said, you know, no, I don't think I need that. And actually, a strange thing happened in 2008 when the financial crisis hit, was all these people who were sort of in big rooms with lots of Bloombergs were sort of driving each other up the wall with sort of tales of how terrible everything was. And I was just sort of like hanging out at home, surrounded by the stabilizing factors of my wife and children, and did some fairly decent decisions. So what started as a sort of necessity and actually then became something I did out of conviction. And so I was a one-man show for most of the last sort of 20 or so years, and then since 2 years, I have a partner, Andreas, who's also with me. But I don't want you to all feel like I live in this sort of paradisical status. There's trouble in paradise, and one of the things that sort of makes life very difficult is is regulation. And, you know, you have on the one hand the European regulators who want you to sort of treat customer data as sacrosanct. Then you have the SEC who wants access to the customer data. So if anyone has any good solutions for that, then I'm all open. But at least the flag is a big plus. Okay, and then so one slide on how I invest, which I'm sure will be very familiar to you. This is actually a painting which is hangs in my office and which my wife very kindly painted for me. She's here today, so perhaps a round of applause for her. And it just shows, you know, the three criteria which I unashamedly lifted from Warren Buffett, which I invest by, which is looking for first and foremost a management with talent and integrity, a price which is attractive, and buying companies which are which have wide moats. And if I look back at my history at speaking at this this conference, I spoke at the very first time in 2014 here. When I talked about sort of valuation and what constitutes an attractive price, and then it couldn't have been too awful because 3 years later Bob invited me back in 2017, and in my 2017 presentation I talked about management and how to find great managers and why it's important to find great managers, and as you probably noticed, there's a sort of a 3-year rhythm developing here, and my hope was sort of to come back in May 2020 and sort of complete the trilogy, talk about moats, and then sort of my work is done, all three aspects are covered, and I could just sort of ride off into the sunset and live a happy retirement from the Value Investing Conference. But of course, this happened, and so my 2020 talk was unfortunately not to be. But thankfully, I had a question at my annual meeting in Engelberg this January when someone obviously very observant sort of asked the question, Rob, you've spoken at Bob's conference about management, you've spoken about valuation, when are you going to talk about moats? And so that video found its way to Bob, and he very kindly invited me here and really delighted to be
here. Is she here today for us?
I'm not sure if I saw her yesterday evening at the Humboldt dinner, but I don't think I see her here. If not, I would have definitely invited a round of applause. Now, I know my 2014 and 2017 presentations are all very fresh in everybody's minds. But just in case there's anyone here today who wasn't there then, I thought we'd just do a very quick recap of the main messages from those presentations. The first one was about, I should preface this by saying, of course, I think all value investors, manage money according to sort of the idea of trying to find good businesses, pay attractive prices, and find good managers. And of course, it would be quite a sort of a boring presentation if everyone just sort of came out and said the same thing. And so what I tried to do in the last two presentations, also the one you're about to hear, or which you are indeed already hearing, is sort of try to take a slightly sort of controversial view on each of these topics and try and poke a little bit of a hole in it. So when I talked about attractive price, what I wanted to get to people was there was a sort of orthodoxy at the time that as a value investor, you only bought things if they're trading at a discount to their book value or at a low price to earnings multiple. And if you weren't doing that, then you just weren't really a real value investor. You were, you were a glamour investor or something else. And in any rate, you would certainly not welcome in the guild, and you should go off and, ply your trade elsewhere. So I set up this sort of, I introduced this idea of sort of five friends, which I called Mr. Value Trap, Mr. Value Stock, Mr. Growth Stock, Mr. Good Business, and Mr. Great Business. And for each of those businesses, I just sort of set up a sort of some simple modeling assumptions. The Value Trap has 0% growth and a little bit of cost inflation. Then the Value Stock, kind of no growth, no cost inflation, and so on, until you got to the Great Business, which I defined as having a 5% growth, which is all through pricing power. So every 100% of that growth goes straight to the bottom line. And a kind of an astonishing thing happens when you do that is you get this incredible dispersion of earnings. Now, of course, you can adjust those numbers to make them say whatever you want, but I think the point I was trying to get to is it's astonishing. With just sort of 0% growth and 2% cost inflation, basically just over a five-year period, you know, your earnings basically go to zero. So there's almost no price you could possibly pay for that company where you would actually make money. And then on the great business, with just, you know, 5% growth, which is, you know, not the most enormous amount of money you can imagine in the world, but with all the kind of the operating leverage and the pricing power coming through, you get this sort of enormous explosion in earnings. You know, it goes up almost 4x in 5 years. And if you sort of plug that into assumptions on what multiple you can pay to get a 0% return all the way up to a 20% return, basically the value trap, there's low price you can basically play. And you know, for the great business, even, you know, even if you're looking for a 20% return, you could theoretically play 12 times EBIT for that. So that's just a very quick summary. The presentation is on my website. If you want to look into more detail, I point you there. But I thought it's helpful just as a recap, but also because some of this is going to feed through into what I talk about on moats as well. So then fast forward 3 years, a few more gray hairs, and I came back on the 5th of May, 2017, and talked about identifying managers with talent and integrity. And here also, I think I had a few sort of messages where, you know, which sort of went a little bit against the grain of how value investors thought about investing then, and perhaps to a certain extent even do now. So first point, which I think probably everyone would agree on, is management is important. It's the difference between, can be the difference between a company being very successful or not. Although even there, you know, there's this famous Warren Buffett quote where he sort of says, you know, when a management with a reputation for greatness meets a business with, you know, reputation for terrible economics, it's the reputation of the business that remains intact. So even there, there's sort of like maybe some, I think some people have maybe interpreted that to mean, you know, really just concentrate on the business, don't worry too much about the management. But no, I think the management is important. Then the next point is, you know, assessing management is possible, but difficult. And here too, you know, I think a lot of there's a certain group of investors will say, "Listen, managers, they're such good salespeople. You know, you're never going to spot it if they're, you know, they're doing something or whatever. So you may as well not even bother trying." And you know, and I think the combination of those two ideas is very powerful. You've got something which is important, and which others are finding difficult and potentially not even trying to do. And those two things strike me as being having the two key ingredients for outperformance, you know, something important and something overlooked. Then I also argued the key criteria, obviously there's lots of desirable characteristics you would look for in any individual or manager, but really the key one is sort of integrity. Because, you know, maybe, you know, 50 years ago, the manager, you know, you had these sort of very hierarchical organizations where all of the instructions sort of came from the top, and so you just needed this genius at the top who, you know, micromanaging every element of the business. But of course, in a modern corporation, that's not the case. People are encouraged rightly to make decisions autonomously. And really the role of a CEO is to, you know, set a good example, make sure people live the values that the company wants to live by. And so, you know, kind of integrity is really, I would argue, the single most important thing. And then, of course, the question, well, how on earth do you figure out whether someone is a good manager or not? And, you know, in the presentation, there's a lot of ideas around that. But to summarize the most important one, I would say it is, it's basically by working on yourself, which is an odd thing perhaps to say. But what sort of really drew my attention to this idea was a quote that I saw in The Snowball, which I'll quickly read, where it says, "Buffett saw himself in Ajit being the guy, the vice chairman and who runs the insurance business, who quickly rose in his esteem to share Mrs. B's pinnacle." Mrs. B was the lady who ran the Nebraska Furniture Mart. "He had no background in insurance." So Ajit had no background in insurance. And Buffett said, "I just liked the guy." And so the way Buffett underwrites great managers is, you know, it basically comes down to this visceral, not rational, visceral sense of, do I like the person? And then you think about, well, what does it mean if you like someone? And it's really sort of like a two-party transaction. So, you know, I'm standing here now, many of you will be getting a visceral reaction on whether you like me or not. And, you know, if you think about it, that's partly due to to who I am, but probably more importantly, it's whether what I'm saying is resonating with how you think about the world. And you know, that's of course true in everything else. So if you want to find managers that have the values which you think are important, you better live by those values, because if you don't, you're not going to be able to spot them. Okay, so we now get to the presentation proper, which is about moats. How am I doing on time, Bob?
You're doing great.
Good, okay. So what I did was put together a very quick primer on what moats are. Don't worry, I'm assuming it's a sophisticated crowd here, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but I thought it would be worth just sort of laying out the ground a little bit, and then I'm going to sort of maybe poke some holes into how people typically think about moats. So, quick primer. A quote from Warren Buffett, of course. The key to investing is not assessing how much an industry is going to affect society or how much it will grow, but rather determining the competitive advantage of any given company and, above all, this is my emphasis, the durability of that advantage. So Buffett's saying it doesn't matter if something's growing, whether it's important. He's saying how the most important thing is the moat. So point number one, this is a super important thing to think about. What are the moats? Sure, this will be familiar with all of you. There's five main ones. You can slice and dice them a little bit different ways, but the first one is switching costs. The idea behind switching costs is it's like very expensive. You know, for example, a small part in an airplane which has been sort of certified to fly in the sky, a little screw or whatever, and you know, it's costs way more to switch out that screw than to get a new one certified and whatever, than simply pay whatever the $10 or the $20 or whatever it is the regulated supplier demands. So there you have a sort of a competitive advantage. Then you have kind of cost advantages, you know, Costco being probably the greatest example, where they have so much money they spend. Oh, sorry, they have such high amount of purchase volume that they get discounts and they pass those on to the customer, and that leads to even higher discounts in a sort of virtuous circle. Then you have network effects. Social networks are there, probably a good example where the value in a social network is where you find lots of interesting people on there or interesting content. A social network with nobody on it would of course be worthless. Then you have brand and reputation. So reputation might be sort of a trusted advisor. Brand would be, there's two types of brand. Ones that sort of promise sort of authenticity and trust, a washing powder. You have the washing powder on your skin, so they're the most interesting brand or the best brand is the one which you trust. And then, of course, you have brands like luxury goods, which sort of give you status. So two different types of effect there. And then the final one is regulation, sometimes quite closely related to switching costs, but once something gets regulated, like a drug or something, it's very difficult to move away from it. Okay, so that's laying out the ground, and now we get to the myths. So I think the first myth I wanted to address is that, the wider the moat, the better. And I don't think that's the case. And actually, you remember, if I'm going back to the first slide, you have this view of from my office of Lake Zurich, and the analogy I thought of to kind of to demonstrate that is, imagine two rowing boats on Lake Zurich sort of chasing each other. It's a very long lake. It's about 40 miles long. And you can imagine two sort of situations. You could have one situation where there's a rowing boat and it's sort of like 5 kilometers ahead of the other one. So miles ahead. You can almost not see the other rowing boat. But crucially, the rowing boat behind it is moving faster. At some point, that boat is going to catch up. It doesn't matter if the lead is 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers, whatever, but if the boat behind is moving faster than the boat in front, then it's going to catch up at some point. So by far the most important characteristic of a moat is not whether it's narrow or if it's wide, but whether it's improving, whether it's getting, whether the moat is getting wider. And the company that sort of really opened my eyes to this idea is actually Google. So I invested in Google, I think in about sort of 2012, wrote it up in my letter. All my letters are on my website. You're very welcome to register and read them if you're interested. And you know, so I wrote my reasons for investing in Google back in 2012. And you know, I sort of argued that you know they had this sort of wonderful network effect, that the more searches they had, the better the results, and then the better the results, the more searches they got in a virtuous circle, which I guess is true in a way. But if you think back to sort of 2012, Google was a very simple website where you'd have sort of 10 blue links. And you know, clearly, if Google had sort of remained that company it was in 2014, there's no way that investment would have worked out as well as it did. You know, the reason Google was a successful investment over the subsequent years is because they kept on developing, kept on making the moat wider. So my first sort of contention for you would be is not wider is better, but whether a moat is widening is the key question to think about. Moat myth number two, all moats are created equal. So, oh, you might have noticed the artwork here is pretty awesome. And while I normally consider myself to be a modest guy, I should say I did this all myself. I just went into ChatGPT and did the prompt. Okay, so there's this idea that, you know, as long as a company has a moat, you know, it's great. Who cares what type of moat it is? It just has to be, you know, it just has to have a moat. I would argue, though, that not all moats are created equal. And the lens with which I'd invite you to think about this is as a friend. So this is maybe a callback to my presentation from 2014, where I had the five friends, you know, Mr. Good Business, Mr. Value Business, Mr. Value Trap. Here I'd like to introduce you to six new friends and describe your relationship with them. So the first one is Mr. Regulator. And this is the guy who, everything is totally cool if you're using his product and paying for it. You know, think of a branded drug or something like that. But if at some point you're like, this drug seems pretty expensive and doesn't seem to be adding a lot of value to me, couldn't I get someone else to make it for me? He'll be like, that's not going to happen. This is not something you could do. So his sort of interests are aligned with you while everything is going well, but as soon as like the product suddenly is no longer sort of fulfilling your needs as a customer, that's where sort of the interests diverge. Then you have a similar situation with Mr. Switch. Here I've got an image of a gangster. So this is like the guy who, not like the regulator where, you know, it's just, you're not allowed. If you do it, you're going to prison. Here, theoretically, you could switch, but you know, it's an awfully nice family you've got there. It would be such a shame if something were to happen to them. So here too, I would say it's a moat that in a way doesn't really work, at least from a customer perspective, because the only time that moat would be important is if you're dissatisfied with the product. And you know, if you're happy, then who cares whether the switching costs? You don't want to switch. But if you're unhappy, then you can't switch. And then it sort of removes the incentive from the company to repair whatever the problem is, because you're kind of stuck anyway. So over time, you would imagine that the needs of the customer and the nature of the service the company is providing would sort of diverge. So as we move along, we're getting into what I think is sort of better moats, but also not ideal ones. So you've got now, you know, if you think of a brand like an expensive watch or a Ferrari or whatever, this is Mr. Status. This is the guy that when you hang out with him, everyone thinks you're cool. You know, you walk up to the line in a discotheque and, you know, you immediately get sort of shunted through to the front because, you know, Mr. Status is with you. And here I would argue, you know, that's a fun friend to have, certainly a role for it in life, but probably not the most reliable of friends. And here too, I would argue, you know, the things that provide you status at one moment in time are not necessarily going to be the ones that provide you status in 10 years' time. Now, I know, as I say that, probably a lot of you are thinking of some of the luxury goods brands like, you know, Louis Vuitton and whatever other ones there are, thinking, didn't they live 100 years or so, Rob? Are you sure this is as tenuous as you think? And there I'd say sort of, you know, two things. Firstly, those are obviously the survivors. There's plenty of brands that no longer are particularly valuable. But also B, you know, of course, you know, Louis Vuitton was, you know, making little suitcases in his workshop over 100 years ago. But this sort of phenomenon that sort of Chinese factory girls have to have a little sort of Louis Vuitton purse in order to feel accepted in their sort of peer group, that's a very modern phenomenon. And whether that will be the case in 10 years' time remains to be seen. So those three, as you probably guessed, are my sort of least favorite moats. We're now getting into my much preferred moats. So now we have, like, you know, Mr. Advisor, which sort of is a representative of reputation. And here, this is a friend you can go to, and you always get great advice. He's got your interests at heart. You know, here there's a very good alignment between what you want and what he wants. This is, I would say, a moat which is going to be self-reinforcing over time. Similarly with a network effect as well. The great things about network effects is, you know, as the business grows, the value to the customer grows as well. So the bigger a social network is, for example, the more content it has on it, the more interesting people, the more friends, it gets more valuable over time. So here too, you have a great alignment between the interests of the customer and the interests of the business. But the all-time sort of goat moat, didn't realize that was going to rhyme. That's a the goat moat is, of course, cost savings. This is the friend who, like, not only gives you good advice, but, like, is actively out there batting for you. Like, you want to buy something, they will tell you where you can get it cheaper. You know, it's sort of dollars in the pocket. And, you know, obviously companies like Costco and Amazon and many others are the ones that sort of spring to mind when you do that. So I would say there's a hierarchy of moats, especially when seen through the lens of, you know, customer interest and long-term alignment. Now, I don't think this is a perfect mental model to think about moats. You know, clearly some of the most stable businesses over time have been software businesses, which benefit very much from a switching cost. So I don't think this is sort of a fully explanatory model, but I think it's an interesting one. And if, like a lot of businesses say, their sort of main goal is to align their business with the customer interests, then, you know, I think that's this sort of model here is a great way to think about it. So we're now on to moat myth number three, which is, like, execution doesn't matter. So there's this sort of idea that, like I mentioned the quote earlier on, well, actually I've got it up here. When a management with a reputation for brilliance tackles a business with a reputation for bad economics, it is the reputation of the business that remains intact. So this sort of is a bit of a callback to my presentation on management. And, you know, it sort of implies that as long as the moat is there, like, nothing can go wrong and vice versa. You know, if the moat isn't there, then nothing is basically going to go right. And, you know, I really strongly disagree with that. Some of the best businesses, some of the best investments I've seen are in the companies which have really great execution, and that execution tends over time to lead to a moat. So I think kind of people get it backwards a little bit. It's not that, you know, kind of, you know, the moat sort of trumps execution. It's that the moat is the output of execution, you know. And the example that springs to mind from that, am I still doing okay for time, Bob? 10 minutes, okay, so very quick anecdote on this one. No, we're almost done, actually. Is Carvana, one of my investments. They're an online retailer of used cars in the USA, and it's a very complicated business that they have. You know, you can imagine there's all these cars you have to move around the country, they purchase them, they do the lending on them, and they have to obviously price them correctly, and, you know, it's just, you know, 1,000 moving parts to the business. But one moving part of that business is the titling. So making sure that when a customer sells a car or another one buys it, that the ownership is properly registered. And it's you know, it's just one minor aspect of the business, but an important one, because if you don't automate that, then the whole kind of, you know, the whole flow of the transaction sort of breakdown and becomes manual. So they struggled for many years with getting the titling sorted out. And it was, you know, a lot of the bureaus where you do the titling in the US are still sort of manually based, so they had to digitize them. And, you know, lots of moving parts, a lot of blocking and tackling. And then at some point they kind of figure it out. And then when they do figure it out, everyone's like, wow, look at this moat. That's impressive. I don't think anyone else is going to be able to figure out titling. But it's sort of backwards, right? I mean, because it's only one part of the business. There's lots of other parts of the business as well. It's not like you that can then sort of sit back and, you know, enjoy this wonderful moat. You have to keep on executing. And if you keep executing, then that moat will grow over time. But it's not the moat that that really sort of secures the business for you. So this one won't be a surprise to you. I kind of talked about it in the summary on the management presentation. But there's this idea that sort of management doesn't matter. And here I have sort of like two examples. So the one is sort of, you know, a crook. And this is sort of the easiest argument to make. Anyone says, you know, management doesn't matter. You know, all that counts is the business and the financial as well. You know, clearly a crook can destroy a business. There's you know, thousands of examples of that. You know, one springs to mind is an Indian brewer, Kingfisher, where the guy effectively, you know, sells the business and buys an airline with it, which goes bust. So, you know, his family went from being very wealthy to zero. You know, so clearly management can destroy a business. I don't think that's a hard argument to make. But on the positive side, you know, clearly management can also be the difference between a great business and a failing business. And of course, the most famous example of that ever is Berkshire Hathaway, the company we're all here to see tomorrow. You know, as many of you will know, Berkshire Hathaway was a failing textile mill, and you know, would have almost certainly gone bankrupt, and is today, I think, one of the top 10 largest companies in the US, if not in the world. And you know, that's thanks to the investment decisions and the investing acumen of Warren Buffett. You know, so clearly management does matter. And then finally, I would say the moat myth number five is that moats always matter. And here I've got two images up. And what this is supposed to show is one in, on the left-hand side, or yeah, from on the left-hand side, this sort of very old, unchanging, stable economy. And then on the right-hand side, the image is sort of supposed to show sort of like a very dynamic, modern, fast-changing economy. Now, if you imagine a world where things basically never change, then yes, clearly moat is very, very important and probably the only thing that counts. You know, so imagine, you know, 300 years ago where basically everyone sort of lived and worked on the land, and you had sort of this tiny fraction of people who owned all of the land, had big, beautiful manor houses, and then you had the sort of the peasants who sort of worked the land and you know, for just enough to probably survive and feed their families. You know, clearly you wanted to be the landowner in that situation. But I would contrast that with a much more modern dynamic situation where things are sort of permanently changing. And I would ask, if you have a wide moat, you know, whether it's switching cost or a brand or whatever, is that an advantage or is it perhaps even a disadvantage? And I would argue in a fast-changing economy, it's probably a disadvantage to have a moat because it's going to make you fat and lazy, and it's going to slow you down when it comes to reacting to competitive threats. So in a sort of like a more of a sort of a dynamic economy, you really want companies which have great execution, and you should be actually actively fearful if the moat is too wide, because that's probably going to slow them down. And they're the sort of the company that really springs to mind today a little bit is maybe Google as well, because they obviously it's become this enormous, very sort of overbloated, complacent organization facing an existential threat, perhaps also opportunity in the AI transition. And if AI turns out to be a sustaining innovation for Google, then they'll do fine. They're integrated into their search engine. Everything will be fantastic. But if it means reimagining the business from scratch, out competing all these sort of startups entering the space, then frankly, I'm pessimistic for Google. So those are the five moats. I'll bring it all together with the conclusion and then take your questions. So one, a widening moat is preferable to a wide moat. Two, some moats improve with time, others decay. Three, Moats are an output of a great business, not an input. 4, management can create, but more importantly, they can also destroy moats. And finally, moats are most valuable in static economies and least valuable in dynamic economies. So that was the presentation. I hope I'm on track time-wise. And happy to take any questions. One there and then maybe at the back.
This is Gary from New York. Your letter has been a great resource to learn investing, so thank you for that. I want to ask about growth. Mm-hmm. I guess when you try to assess companies' growth potential, other than moat, what are the things you think about?
So just to repeat the question, so apart from growth, and what was the other one?
No, try to when you assess companies' growth potential, other than moat, what else you think about?
Well, I mean, it's really like, you know, like I had in the presentation here, you know, first and foremost, I look to the management. You know, I need to know that I trust the management, because ultimately I'm giving them my wallet to take care of. And so in the negative, if they're dishonest, then, you know, my wallet's going to be stolen. And in the positive, if they're great managers who are aligned with the business and motivated, then, you know, that's going to be a rocket ship, which you really want to stick with. So I'd say management is by far the most important thing that I would look for. And then obviously the moats, as we just discussed. And then, of course, valuation. You know, you want to make sure you're paying a fair or ideally even a cheap price for a business. And here I think sometimes it might be a little bit confusing, because of course, every investment ultimately is a calculation of present value. You know, you don't have, you know, $1 bill is the same value as another dollar bill. So why not just sort of concentrate on valuation and sort of forget all the other stuff? And there I would simply argue that, you know, if there isn't sort of some competitive advantage and honest management, then it's probably not going to have much value in the long term in the company. So the kind of the valuation exercise is completely moot.
Thank you for sharing. I would love to ask you the company Carvana. Mm-hmm. I did research, but it was just very complicated. I didn't get involved. And yeah. It's a roller coaster. And very high quality investor get involved. So, but it fell like 99% at the lowest point, right? So I would love to ask like your view on what is the real mode of Carvana. And do you think if you would do it again, would you still invest the company, or it will be like in the bucket of too difficult to design that bucket?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. So, I mean, like, you know, I think what gets me and so many other people excited about it is, you know, the used car market is this enormous market, 40 million cars sold every year. No player has more than about a 2% market share today. So, you know, this sort of incredible runway for growth, and a customer experience which is just, you know, 100x better than in a traditional dealership when you transact with Carvana. So I've been into quite a few used car dealerships because I have an investment in a lending business there. And, you know, they call the place where the salespeople hang out waiting for customers to come in, they call it the shark tank. So you have all these sort of sharks sort of prowling around, you know, going swimming back and forth, waiting for prey to come in. It's truly a horrible experience. So, and Carvana, you just sit in the comfort of your home, you press a button, and if everything goes well, the car can even be delivered on the same day. So an experience which is just, you know, orders of magnitude better than the existing one, and a runway which is, you know, almost sort of unlimited from today's perspective. So that's sort of what got people excited. But the question mark is, of course, can you make that work? Can you make the unit economics work? And, you know, fortunately, I think, seeing how the business has developed over the last year or so, that answer has been answered in the positive. But if I look back to the trajectory the company was on 3 years ago, you know, it was probably on the wrong trajectory. The debt was going up, the business wasn't making free cash flow. And so if I were to do things differently, I would probably have put the business in the too hard bucket 3 years ago. Today I would certainly see it as not in the too hard bucket. Thank you.
Rob, hi.
One last question, Rob.
Okay.
Thanks, firstly, for the great presentation and for all the sharing that you do so generously. The question I have is really on the slide that you put up of superior businesses, and you can pay a higher price for them. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience with owning at times Carvana with, I believe, no earnings to a PDD recently where it does have earnings? Mm-hmm. And just how do you take that thought forward into holding on to superior businesses? Mm-hmm. You had owned Novodosek, for example.
Yeah.
You had owned Google. If you had done nothing over the last 5 years, do you think your portfolio would have been better off just holding on to those great businesses?
Yeah. Well, if I'd done nothing in the last 5 years, I might have done nothing 5 years prior to that as well. So, no, I mean, like, the key point on this chart, and for that matter, any of the slides in this presentation, is the assumption that your analysis is correct. Right. If you correctly identify the great business, and you know, like the one here, then it's going to work out spectacularly well as an investment. But of course, you have to get your analysis right. And you know, I think the point of this chart was not to say, hey, just buy the great business. Any of these business, the value trap can't be a good investment under almost any price assumption. All of the others can be good investments if bought at a let me see if I can go forward one. Yeah, if bought at the correct price. So, you know, like if you buy the Mr. Growth business, which is a fairly average sort of growing business at 4x EBIT, you're going to make 20% return over 5 years, which is great. So the point of the chart was not to say just buy the great business, ignore everything else. The point was to say any company can be a value investment if analyzed properly.
Rob, how can they access your letters and this presentation?
Yeah, so I'll post the presentation on my website.
And your website is?
rvcapital.ch.
rvcapital.ch.
That's right. You have to register, but everyone here is very welcome to register, and I'll approve. Just maybe put a quick note that you're at the conference, and then I'll be very happy to approve the application.
So join me in thanking Rob Vanel for his excellent presentation.